I want to focus, if I might, in my remarks on my job as a prosecutor and how it intersects, and it does intersect almost immediately, with my faith as a Catholic. And it intersects in an easily identifiable way as a sworn servant of the king, or in this instance, the federal government. It is my obligation to seek the truth. And having been raised in the Catholic tradition, the Catholic faith, it's a relatively easy process for me. I would note that the sponsors of today's remarks, the Thomistic Institute, is supported and run by Dominicans. And as it happens, as some of you may know, the motto of the Dominicans order is Veritas, or truth. The real beauty of being a prosecutor, notwithstanding what some perspectives on being a prosecutor may be, is that it affords a lawyer, in my instance, myself for 40 years, and a fellow who just came in the courtroom, Bill Nardini, who graduated from this law school not many years ago as the chief of the criminal division, it affords you the opportunity to be a truth seeker and to focus your exclusive attention on trying to seek out the truth and doing justice in all circumstances. Indeed, for those of you who are looking for security in your professional lives, I can recommend the prosecution to you, because the only way a prosecutor can actually get him or herself in any kind of serious trouble is if that prosecutor were to do something that he or she knew was not right, or which tended to hide the truth, or at least portions of the truth. Will made reference to a matter going back to 1968. Mr. Nardini and I were in Boston conducting investigations relating to alleged corruption on the part of FBI agents and their unholy relationship with various informants, most particularly Irish mobsters in Boston. And in the course of doing that investigation, we came upon wiretaps that had been conducted by the FBI prior to the current Title III affidavit or statutes, where the FBI had recorded conversations of the then head of the patriarch family of the LCN, never disclosed. And in those recordings, or a number of the recordings, it became pretty clear that it was FBI informants and not the people who were convicted of a particular murder who were responsible for that murder. In retrospect, I suppose it's easy for you all, for all of us, to think, oh, well, of course you have to disclose that. And of course, we did. What made it particularly easy for us, I think, is our heritage and how we were raised, that the truth is the truth, and we were obligated in all instances to seek the truth. So we ended up disclosing wiretap information and related documents, which, as Will indicated, resulted in convictions being overturned, a civil suit being filed, and the federal government being held responsible to the tune of $101 million in civil damages to those people. But as I say, the intersection of my personal Catholic faith and my duty and obligation as lawyer are pretty easily recognized. Let me just speak briefly about my background and how I come to this job. I'm obviously a good deal older than all of you. Probably you could put a number of your ages together and I'd still be older than you. But my upbringing was pre-Vatican II. I grew up in a 1950s environment in which a particular Catholic bishop, Fulton Sheen, had a program, Life is Worth Living. There's a Catholic bishop who had a television program, and it was the number one rated program in America at the time. Things have obviously drastically changed in that regard. But having been brought up in that tradition and with figures like Fulton Sheen have been formative for me, and I think end up being principles that I try to apply in my daily life. I was brought up in a small town in Massachusetts. And that experience clearly impacts my view as a prosecutor, not necessarily as a Catholic prosecutor, but as a prosecutor, in that I have an urge, a desire, a focus on trying to protect the less fortunate, particularly the weak and the vulnerable in our communities. I grew up in a small town in Massachusetts. There's no fear of drugs, no fear of violence being visited upon people, no fear of predators, all the things that so undermine peace and security in our communities today. I do ask myself fairly often, I did as a parent and now as a grandparent, how have we gotten so far removed from this basic fundamental obligation in our society to maintain a culture in which we can raise our kids in a safe and secure environment? Now, some of that feeling, I know, I am absolutely certain, comes from my having been raised in the particular faith that I was. Another part of it is my grandfather was a police officer, and I saw him as a hero in my own eyes. And I see police officers who are willing to do the things that most of the rest of us are unwilling to do in a particular light. Police officers step over the line. I just mentioned that police officers cost the federal government $101 million, or FBI agents did. So there's no doubt that police officers do things wrong. That having been said, police officers are incredible men and women who do those things that the rest of us, as I say, are generally not willing to do, and in all candor, are afraid to do. In the 1960s, I had something of my own awakening in terms of my faith and what I wanted to do with my life. It wasn't exactly clear what I wanted to do, but I had a general idea. And there, at the time, Robert Bolton's play, subsequently turned into a movie, Man for All Seasons. If you haven't seen it, you should see it, because it's life-altering to some folks. It certainly was to me. It helped me begin to discern or see, to separate the BS from real things in life, and a willingness to try to speak truth to power, as the current idiom goes. I was also young enough to believe in the possibility of changing the world. As I think it's attributed to Churchill, but it's probably erroneously so attributed. If you're not a liberal at 25, you have no heart. If you're not a conservative at 35, you have no brains. And there's a certain truth, my own experience, a certain truth to that observation. In the 1960s, social revolution, I was in college in the 60s, civil rights movement, anti-war movement. But there was also sex, drugs, and rock and roll, which don't seem to have abated to any great extent in the interim. There is open, often violent efforts to change American society in those heady days. But for me, there is also people like Mother Teresa and Dorothy Day and the Catholic Workers' Movement and Alexander Solzhenitsyn and William Buckley Jr. from Harriet Yale, Malcolm Muckridge and others, who spoke with a different but certainly related voice as to how we ought to conduct ourselves as responsible adults. So what did I do? I ended up going to law school myself. I thought, okay, well, we got to make a lot of change, and one way to do it is to go to law school. So I applied to law school. I got into law school. I personally worked my way through law school, and I worked for something called the Connecticut Planning Committee on Criminal Justice, where I had more involvement on a regular basis with police officers and judges and probation officers and decent people who wanted to bring some real change to the criminal justice system as it existed in Connecticut at the time. As I went through law school, I had a high draft number. For those of you younger than, well, probably pretty much everybody here, it used to be there was a draft, right? There's a lottery. You got a low number, you went to Vietnam. You got a high number, you never even went into the service. Providentially or otherwise, I got a very high number in the draft. But I knew, I believe that I had an obligation to do public service, and so my wife and I volunteered for the Volunteers in Service America, VISTA program. My wife worked with mentally handicapped children. She still does that work, and I provided legal services to indigent Native Americans in the Crow Indian Reservation in Montana. Our first child was born out on the reservation. He was born on August 15th, which happens to be the Feast of the Assumption in the Catholic Church, and on the 200th anniversary of our nation's independence. Providentially, at that time, an opening occurred in the Chief State's Attorney's Office here in Connecticut. And at least looking back, it's hard for me to see the trajectory of my own life not having somehow been providentially impacted by the Chief State's Attorney's opening and my coming back here, because as we've said, I've been at this now for some 40 plus years. So again, just quickly, by way of background, I ended up having the opportunity to try dozens and dozens of cases in Connecticut's lower courts. I was able to write appeals, and trust me, I needed a lot of work learning how to properly write appellate briefs. I get to argue in the Connecticut appellate courts, including the Connecticut Supreme Court, and occasionally in the Second Circuit. I would say that it was when I came back to Connecticut that probably I had my first inkling of my need to recognize and to truly be grateful for what had happened to me in terms of my legal career. I knew nobody at law schools. There were no lawyers in my family. My father was the first person in our family to go to college. I had no hooks, and yet I found myself in this situation of going to the Chief State's Attorney's Office and being a young lawyer. Fortuitously, or maybe providentially, depending upon your view of life, I met a fellow by the name of Arnold Markle, who was the state's attorney here in New Haven. He was a larger-than-life person, known as the Chief. He was a mentor. He was a rock. Unlike many people, he didn't whine when the Supreme Court was handing down decisions he didn't like. He went out and he taught police officers. He created courses to instruct them on how to carry out investigations in conformity to the Constitution. While the Chief was Jewish and I was Catholic, we had very similar mindsets, sort of soulmates of a sort. And I came here then to New Haven and was able to run a career criminal office where I only prosecuted repeat felony offenders for murder, sexual assault, assault first and second degree. I dealt with hundreds and hundreds of victims and their families. Saw the dark side, and continue in my current job, in some instances, to see the dark side of life. But it also afforded the opportunity to serve people, as I believe we are all obligated to do. Dealt with more police officers and was able to gauge their dedication and motivation in this regard. You know, there's that whole series of movies, the Dirty Harry movies, which some of you may have seen. And in one of them, I forget the exact plot line, but there was a black militant who had said to Harry Callahan, you know, Callahan, why do you risk your life for people who wouldn't let you in their front door any more than they would let me in? And the response from Callahan was, if I told you, you wouldn't believe me. And I learned that from police officers. Notwithstanding the narratives, notwithstanding the public discussion on some of these matters, for most police officers, men and women, if they told you why they did it, why they're willing to go into houses where they know that there are guns and violent people, you wouldn't believe it. But the truth of the matter is because they're dedicated to serving their fellow citizens. Again, certainly not true for all police officers, not true for all agents. But for the vast majority of them, that is their motivating factor. And as a Catholic, I have a similar motivation in trying to serve as best I can in the role of federal prosecutor and now as the United States attorney. I finished up with work with Mr. Markle's office, and at the time I was prosecuting, Mr. Markle asked me to prosecute an organized crime case. A fellow named Mozzolivo over in East Haven had walked out of his father's restaurant, and some people who were associated with an LCN family tried to kill him. They had a shotgun. Fortunately, they had been drinking dandelion wine all afternoon, and so they missed Mutt's kid when they fired at him. But I ended up prosecuting that case, and in the end, it worked out all right. That was my first venture into organized crime matters. The defendants were convicted, despite the fact that the victim recanted his testimony in the middle of the trial. The next thing I knew, and again, I consider this providential in my life, I get a call from the Department of Justice, the Organized Crime and Racketeering Section, from a fellow by the name of David Margolis. David had been an assistant United States attorney here in Connecticut before going on to become the chief of the organized crime strike forces in Brooklyn and Cleveland, and then the head of the organized crime and racketeering section down at the Department of Justice. And David asked me if I would come over to the federal side and begin to investigate organized crime matters. And with the encouragement of Mr. Markle, I agreed to do it, and so I became a strike force lawyer, looking at organized crime here throughout New England. In those days, we were not answerable to the United States Attorney. We were only answerable through Bobby Kennedy's strike forces, or the strike forces that Bobby Kennedy had set up in Washington. It was an unbelievable and unexpected opportunity, but by this time in my life, I was all in. The general commitment to seek first the kingdom of God, and come what may. And my wife said, do it. And I left the state system and became a strike force lawyer with the Department of Justice. That time of my life, there's probably no better job that I've ever had. There were just two lawyers. It's like a tiny little law firm that somebody was paying for. Two lawyers, secretary, a labor racketeering agent, and we would chase those people who had power through violence, who people were deathly afraid of, and had been untouchable because people were so afraid of these individuals. And so you get to chase bad guys. Well, how do my Catholic principles come into that equation? When I was sworn in as an attorney with the Department of Justice, I took an oath. That oath requires that you swear to uphold the Constitution and the laws of the United States, which I did. My Catholic faith had given an added layer of importance to that oath, right? Ten Commandments, one of the Big Ten, being you shall not lie. And so whether I've done organized crime cases, or I'm looking at CIA conduct, or I've been involved in looking at things in Boston and corruption up there, I've taken my oath to uphold the Constitution of the United States and the laws of the United States seriously. And when I've sworn that I won't disclose classified information, for example, I take that seriously. And not just because you're obligated to do it under the oath, it might be a violation of a statute or regulation, but I consider it an unbreakable and solemn trust that I have been given. Thomas More, who is the patron saint of lawyers, had this to say about an oath. When a man takes an oath, he's holding his own self in his own hands, like water. And if he opens his fingers then, he needn't hope to find himself again. That is, if one violates his oath, his public life, his public trust is lost. And I have tried to the best of my ability as a federal prosecutor, and prior to that in the state system, to adhere to the oaths that I have taken as a lawyer and as a Catholic. My colleagues, Mr. Nardini being one of the most prominent, I consider our oaths to be just that, an unbreakable trust. We may make mistakes, we may stumble, we may even fall trying to carry out our duties, but we understand we simply cannot break our oaths to uphold the Constitution and the laws of the United States and to defend the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. Let me give you an example of that. I had a number of years back had agreed to try a case for another assistant in our office shortly before the case was being tried. I was going to go to trial. And I tried the case, and in the middle of the case, it turns out that some information had not been disclosed that should have been disclosed. End up disclosing it because it's my obligation as a lawyer, and I swore an oath to adhere to those principles. Now, I got absolutely scorched in a written opinion by a district court judge for whom I tried that case. But in the end, as painful as it was, as burnt as I was by the experience, I knew then and I know now that that was my obligation as a lawyer and as a professing Catholic. For me, I recognize that the Supreme Court, in addressing some of these matters, is exactly right. The Supreme Court said in a case called United States versus Ventresca, referring to an earlier case, that we need to put the reins on law enforcement and those officers who are engaged in the often competitive enterprise of ferreting out crime. I am a very aggressive prosecutor, I think most people who know me would think. And I have to put the reins on myself because I know the competition, right? The competition is to try to win, right? You're a lawyer. Anybody here who wants to be a litigator, you're going to want to win. And that is important. But it is not the most important thing for a lawyer. It's certainly not the most important thing for a prosecutor. And I recognize my own weaknesses in that regard, and I seek guidance in most instances from people in that area. Sometimes we want to ignore what the law requires, you know, in terms of discovery or providing information that you know is going to hurt your case and what your obligations are. And again, I looked at Thomas More, and one of the most famous quotes from Bolt's play is between More and his son-in-law, William Roper. And the exchange goes like this. Roper says, so now you're going to give the devil the benefit of the law? And Thomas More said, yes, what would you do? Cut a great road through the law to get after the devil? And Roper's response is, yes, I'd cut down every law in England to do that. And then More pointedly says, oh, and when the last law was down and the devil turns around on you, where would you hide, Roper? The law's all being flat. This country is planted thick with laws from coast to coast, man's laws, not God's. And if you cut them down and you're just the man to do it, do you really think you could stand upright in the winds that would blow then? Yes, I give the devil the benefit of law for my own safety's sake. And it serves as a reminder, that observation from Thomas More, St. Thomas More, is an observation that while we may not want to hurt our case, or damage our case, we want to win, we want to see justice done, that is not our principal obligation in our current system. And as it turned out, while a strike force lawyer, I had the good fortune to prosecute any number of Genovese crime family members, Gambino members, Patriarchers, Bananos, all which were part of dismantling in large part the LCN in Connecticut and the broader nationwide dismantling of the mafia. All the convictions were upheld on appeal, and I believe that to the best of my ability, I adhered to Moore's advice. Moved over to the United States Attorney's Office, became the chief of the criminal division after time at the strike force. I was permitted to carry over some of my organized crime inventory, the most important of which ended up being prosecution of a Patriarca case. So Boston and Connecticut essentially divided up the entire hierarchy of the New England mob. We prosecuted the murder of the underboss of the family, extortions, loan sharking, and the like, and was able to develop a relationship with folks in Boston in particular, which came to some providential events in the future. But during the ongoing investigation of that matter, the FBI was able to, for the first time, record the making ceremony. Somebody actually became a member of the mafia. And how that went, there was a lot of talk about it. People would suggest it was fantasy. Nope, it was actually done. And it was recorded based on information developed by the FBI here in Connecticut. During the making ceremony, there was a part of it where the person who was being brought into the mafia had a picture of a saint put in his hands, lit on fire, and they had to repeat as part of the mafia oath that as this picture burns, so shall my soul burn if I ever disclose the secrets of the family. Well, as it happens, my strike force partner at the time is a fellow named Bobby Devlin, who's now a Superior Court judge. And Bobby Devlin, who comes from the same faith tradition, among other things, would work for nuns up in North Guilford, Connecticut. It's a monastery up there. And Bobby would do, he'd cut their grass. They were all silenced. The nuns could not talk, but he'd cut grass, he'd do plumbing, he'd do all kinds of things. And during the course of the trial, when this part came out about the burning of the saints and whatnot, the head of the order in North Guilford, who could speak to outsiders, explained to Bob how infuriated the nuns were about having read about this burning of the picture of the saint. And Bobby then explained to her the guy who would actually pull the trigger and kill the underboss, that's what this is all about, had this some kind of religious conversion, and he had this altar set up in his cell, and he was saying all these prayers, and it's getting crazy. And so the nun assured Bobby, this is all unvarnished absolute truth. The nun assures Bobby that, I'm going to have the sister say a novena. We've got to fight fire with fire here. We're going to start praying. So he tried the case to conclusion. We argued the case. It goes to the jury. And the jury doesn't return a verdict at first. And it's a day, and it's 2 days, and it's 4 days. And we get to the 13th day of deliberations, still no verdict. And one of the defense attorneys, a guy named Tony Cardinale, who's a terrific lawyer, I represent a lot of mobsters in Boston and in New York, comes to me and says, you know what today is, don't you? I said, no, what's today? So today's the 13th day of deliberations, and 13, the number 13 is a very lucky number for Italians. And he said, more importantly, it's the Feast of St. Gaetano. Gaetano Milano was the person who shot and killed the underboss of the family. So, of course, I'm trying to get the windows open in the federal courthouse so I can go out, assuming that the jury's going to come back wrong. But the day passes and nothing occurs. So you go to the 14th day, and no verdict. You get to the 15th day, and Bobby Devlin comes in, and he said, you know what today is? I said, no, what's today? He said, it's the Feast of St. Dominic. And so I said, well, is that good or bad? And he said, I'll let you know. This is, again, unvarnished. Maybe 20 minutes later, there's a knock on the door, and the jury's got a verdict. So we go down to the courtroom. It takes a while to assemble. We all stand up, and the jury comes out. They're going to announce and do announce their verdict, and they announce, as to each defendant, that they're guilty of the murder and extortion and the racketeering and the like, at which point Bobby Devlin looks at me, he says, the nuns, they're Dominicans. Honest story about my own experiences as a prosecutor and a Catholic prosecutor at that. In the ensuing years, as Will had indicated, we were asked by a number of folks to go do some investigations outside of Connecticut. Janet Reno, who is a wonderful person, asked that we go up to Boston and take a look at the whole mess involving the FBI and their relationship with Whitey Bulger, Stevie Fleming, and the rest. Bill Nardini came up and worked on those matters with us. Again, unbelievable experience working in Boston on these matters. Not only did we end up having to make the call as to disclosing the old wiretap information that led to people being released from murder convictions, but there are any number of other things that came up that we had to confront. To take this one as an example, our principal focus of attention initially was a fellow by the name of John Conley, who had been a supervising agent of the FBI in Boston. And the allegations were that he had obstructed justice in any number of ways by providing information to the Irish mob, Whitey Bulger and his folks, about people who were cooperating, a number of individuals and not being killed, and the like. That was a principal focus of attention. Well, when it became public that Whitey Bulger and Stevie Fleming had been FBI informants, the co-defendants in a pending RICO case they had were infuriated. some of whom decided that they were going to retaliate in what they thought was an appropriate fashion. So, for example, one of the persons who had been charged along with Bulger and Fleming in a racketeering case was a fellow by the name of John Matarano. John Matarano had personally murdered in excess of a dozen people as part of the Italian and then Irish gang wars in Boston. And Matarano was willing to cooperate and provide information about the relationship, as he knew it, between Bulger and his FBI handler, John Connolly. And so we had to confront some really difficult issues. Do you make a deal with somebody who self-admittedly murdered 12 people? He'd never been charged with any of the murders or not. Do you make that deal? The then boss of the New England or Patriarch crime family, Frank Salemi, who was also a charged defendant in that then pending RICO case, he wanted to come in and testify. Well, do you make a deal with the boss of a crime family to give you information about an FBI agent who you believe was corrupt and corrupted the process or not? Another individual who was charged is a fellow by the name of Kevin Weeks, who himself had beaten any number of people with bats in his fists and otherwise at the direction of Whitey Bulger. Do you make a deal with Kevin Weeks or not? And in trying to arrive at those decisions, what are the principles that you apply? I mean, how do you go about doing that? What are the fundamental questions that need to be asked and explored? And I believe then, and I believe now, that my Catholic faith and the principles on which I was raised made that decision-making a good deal easier. First and foremost was to get to the family members of those people who had been murdered by Bulger and by Matarano and by these others and get their take on it. And ultimately, we did make the decision to use them as witnesses, and ultimately, a jury did convict John Connolly of racketeering and obstruction of justice for his involvement with Bulger, Fleming, and others. We also had to make some similar decisions with relation to a Massachusetts State Police lieutenant who had been retired and had obstructed justice, and like Connolly, had leaked information to the bad guys over a long period of time. Do you make those kinds of deals in those circumstances? And if so, how do you do it? As Will had indicated, a bit later, Attorney General Michael Mukasey asked that we take a look at some CIA matters, particularly related to the destruction of certain videotapes of the waterboarding of terrorist detainees. And Mr. Nardini participated in that as well before he went over to Rome for 3 or 4 years to serve the Department of Justice in Rome. We took an oath not to disclose classified information. It's very distressing when you see how much information is leaked to the press. You can certainly understand the motivation, not necessarily ill motives, but the motivation for disclosing it. But I don't believe that there was any information from our investigation that was ever improperly disclosed, as much as we might like to have had that information provided to the public. Eric Holder, Attorney General Holder, who you're very close with, asked that we do further investigation into the alleged unauthorized treatment of terrorists by the CIA. And again, similar oaths were taken concerning classified information, what could and couldn't be disclosed, much of which was in the public sector or claimed by one or another source of information. It was completely inaccurate. But were precluded from disclosing that information. I took an oath not to disclose it. As much as I might like to, I have not and will not. So I do ask myself, you know, how was it that these various assignments came to me to investigate? And I don't really know, except I do know that I have tried first in my personal life to seek the kingdom of heaven. And I've been given unexplained blessings throughout my adult life. I was born into a wonderful family. I grew up in small-town America, loving parents, wonderful siblings. And I've tried to use those blessings and graces in an appropriate way. And for whatever reason, these various investigations have fallen to me and my much more talented, incredibly talented close friends and colleagues. I also recognize and realize that there are scores of much better educated, more capable, and talented people who might have been selected to conduct these investigations. And I, in all seriousness, don't say this out of some sort of false sense of humility. It's simply a fact, as Mr. Nardini can attest to. But Providence somehow has put in my path people who themselves have known that their country needed them, and they joined in these respective efforts to try to protect the innocent and the weak and the vulnerable. Let me close by making comments on one matter that is maybe is of interest to you, anybody who's struggling or thinking about what do they really want to do with the phenomenal education that you're receiving here at Yale Law School, and with all the opportunities that lie ahead of all of you, given that incredible education. I've had the good fortune to do a lot of things as a lawyer. Some of them have been mentioned here. But the truth of the matter is that the one matter that stands out for me, and I think it's because of my upbringing and my Catholic background and training, is this. On March 26th of 1994, a 7-year-old girl was shot and killed in Hartford, Connecticut. She had been riding in the back seat of her parents' car with her two sisters. The family literally was bringing bread and milk to the grandmother, the child's grandmother. A car full of Los Alitos gangbangers pulled up alongside of that car, opened fire, having mistaken the car for that of a rival group of Latin kings. Mr. Delgado, who was driving the car at the time, was shot in the back, but he survived. Marcelina, however, she had been lying down in the back seat of the car and took one shot to the head and died 3 days later. Her death resulted in the then United States Attorney, now Second Circuit Court of Appeals Judge Christopher Droney, sending me and others to open what some might call, I think Harvard Court may have referred to it as Avenging Angels campaign, to bring some justice to the situation, but more importantly to the Delgado family. After a pretty lengthy investigation, those persons who were responsible for Marcelina's murder, as well as a half dozen or so other murders, multiple shootings, drug trafficking, were all indicted on racketeering charges, and every one of them was convicted, most of them having gone to trial, many of them currently serving life sentences. When the dust had settled on that trial, I met with Mr. and Mrs. Delgado, who had immigrated to the United States in the hope of building a better life for their children. Until this day, and as I stand here now, I cannot forget these two very humble, meek, good people thanking us for holding the murders of their innocent little girl accountable for their conduct, and then telling me that they never thought anyone would care enough about Marcelina and them to do what had been done and bringing justice to the matter. The good Lord has bestowed on me undeserved and immeasurable blessings. My continuing prayer is that I use those blessings not for any kind of personal glory or glory of my colleagues who, like me, are engaged in the oftentimes competitive enterprise of ferreting out crime, but they will somehow be used to advance His greater glory. So you may want to ask yourselves, maybe now or soon, what you want to do when you look back at your own legal careers 40 or 50 years from now, should you be so fortunate to have longevity of life. You know, would it be that you made a ton of money? And that's not a bad thing, because you can do great things with money. Is it you've met some really, really interesting people? And that's not a bad thing either, but I would caution you from my personal experiences that a whole lot of those people are the emperors who are wearing no clothes. Or instead, do you want to look back and say you've fought the good fight, you've run the good race, and did his will as best you're able to do so? So thanks very much for having me here and listening to these remarks. I hope that they might in some way have touched you or touched your lives in a good way. Thanks very much.